Small business owners are always passionate about their work, and they have a lot on the line. Let Verizon help champion your small business dream. Whether you own a small business or scaling one or starting one from scratch, you need to get ready for Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon has your back because they know small businesses can make a big difference. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business.
Hey, everybody. Just wanted to give you a quick heads up here. There's something we should all be doing. It's going to improve your life, make every day a little bit better, and that is eat more Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Yes, think about it. All the gurus, all the coaches out there, they've never said the words, eat more Reese's. I mean, that combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter, I mean, this is something that brings other people and ourselves joy. That's why there's 2 in a pack. Shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold, and often in my pantry because I love these. How is your sock drawer looking? Maybe it's time for some spring cleaning. Well, Bombas just dropped soft new socks, tees, and underwear to help you get that drawer in a better place. And you know what? I just did it. Once you try Bombas, you are not going to look at socks the same way because they are obsessed over details. They have these anti-blister tabs and cushioned footbeds, so your feet feel great. It's like walking on little pillows. It's amazing. I love my Bombas. Get comfy this spring and give back with Bombas. Head on over to bombas.com/bonkers. Use the code bonkers for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/bonkers. Use the code bonkers at checkout. A long heated debate in the helpline comes to an end. The true meaning of a bezoar. And celebrated graphic novelist Ed Brubaker joins Jason and I for a big talk about his newest book, Reckless, episode 3. It's all happening here on today's How Did This Get Made mini episode. Hit the theme! Hello, people of Earth, and welcome to a How Did This Get Made mini episode. I'm your host, Tall John Shear, aka Paul Shear, and this is the podcast where we tell you everything that you need to know for next week's How Did This Get Made episode, what we're watching, where to watch it, and how much it costs. And you get a chance to take the mic to tell us everything that you thought we might have missed, your theories, your thoughts on last week's episode, which of course was Malignant. We also have a very special interview in today's show. I cannot wait to bring you our very special guest. He's a How Did This Get Made all-star, and he will be talking about his brand new book. I'm talking about Ed Brubaker. Jason and I sit down with Ed to talk about Reckless, book 3. If you've not been reading Reckless, you are missing out, but he's going to sit down, talk about, we're going to honestly get ready for a large conversation about Magnum PI, because Jason and I get into it with Ed about our favorite detectives. So we hope you stay tuned for that. I want to give a big shout out to Conjurer. Thank you so much for that amazing theme song, and let you know that we are doing something very special. Every Monday, we're doing something called Matinee Monday, which means we are releasing an old episode from the How Did This Get Made vault for you to go back and look at. And we're trying to correlate the picks to movies that we have done on the show. So our first release is the very controversial, the very, very, I mean, to this day, people are still arguing about it. Drop Dead Fred episode. Are you Team Sanity? Are you Team Fred? A chance to go back and revisit it. If you don't have Stitcher Premium, this is a great chance to hear the whole episode. And you can actually watch a little bit of a video introduction of it and hear a little sound clip of it on my YouTube page. I'm playing around with doing a little bit of this video intros for these How Did This Get Made episodes, because why not? We're in a content-based society. I'm trying to give you all some content. Let's do it. Let's get it out there. More ways to get this show. But enough of my yapping. Let's hear from you, because I know you have problems. Of course you do, with your life, your job, parenting, whatever it is, I'm here to help you. I'm like Oprah without the magazine. I'm like Dr. Phil without the mustache, but with a full beard. I'd love to see Miss Dr. Phil with a full beard. I think you would look good. You ask me questions, I'll give you answers. It is time for the Paul Helpline.
This is Paul's Helpline. Can you dig it? You give him cues, and he gives us A's. And Devin and Cody give a big A too. This is Paul's Helpline. 1-800-PAUL-ASS is another line.
Thank you, Teddy Love Supreme. Here we go. Let's hear from our friend Aaron in Madison.
Hi, Paul. It's Aaron calling from Madison, Wisconsin. And I'm calling for some new parent advice as we approach the holiday season and also my daughter's first birthday. How do I keep our well-meaning relatives from buying us too many toys? It just seems as though every time we see our family, they have these loud, plastic, obnoxious toys to give us. And I know they're well-meaning, and I know they love to shop for the toys, but, you know, we live in a smaller apartment. We try to be pretty minimalist, and we also try to avoid plastics that are unnecessary. And another aspect of this is that, you know, my husband and I are both graduate students. Our family income is quite modest, and so it's just kind of upsetting that they're spending all this money on toys when really what we need is just cash for groceries and daycare. So any advice that you could give us would be really greatly appreciated. Thanks so much. Big fan of the show from day one.
Aaron, wow. This is a very hard question and a very good one because, look, relatives are known for giving your kids the loudest, most annoying toys. They think it's funny, but then you have to bring it home. I have so many Minion fart guns in my house that I have to hide them. I have so many noisemakers, a little gerbil or hamster that dances to music and records your voice. Every annoying gift has been given to me by a relative. I get that. I get that. I understand that. And my first thought was going to be, oh, who cares? Let them give you whatever and then just throw it away. First of all, it's not fair to the kid because you don't want to take away their toys. By the way, I'm a huge, huge recycler of toys. I get them out of the house as quick as they come in because you know if a toy is sticking. And once the new toy's in, the other toys can go away. They don't go back. But I think that you actually bring up a really good point. You have this modest budget, and you have family members who really want to give your kids something. So what if you just go the honesty route? Maybe I'm turning a corner here. Maybe, you know, a lot of times I'm like figuring out ways you can manipulate a situation to say something without actually saying it. Maybe I'm just going to go and say, can we do something very honest and say, family, we love you. Can we do a special thing this year? Because we have a small apartment and we need a little bit more energy in our childcare, that we just commit to one gift under $10 or $15 or $20, whatever you want to do, whatever you feel safe with. And then anything else that you might spend on a toy, you put it in a check and we will put that towards the betterment of our child, whether that's a soccer class, babysitting services, food, whatever it is. You can just kind of label it something like we're putting it in their bank account. It's something that we really want to do, because what we find is we want to give our child the best life possible, and those things will enrich their life. But we also know that you want to give them something in the moment. And if we keep the price down on that and you actually give us something to give year round, it will be such a benefit to us and our family. And I think that that is a really honest way of doing something. Now, they may feel pressure, like, they want money? Are they in trouble for money? But I think if you frame it as if you want this money to enrich your child's life, it's sort of like a honeymoon fund, but for a kid. And I think that that's a brilliant idea. I have a kid who is in 2 basketball classes a week, 1 golf class, and 2 soccer classes. Like, They're doing a lot. My other kid's in Spanish class, improv class. I didn't want him to do improv class. He found out about an improv class. He doesn't know what I do. I don't tell him. I never will. So I think that is my tact. I hope that works. And let me know, because I think this could be really good advice to a lot of people out there, because kids' shit is expensive. I'm buying baby cleats. You know how quick they're going to use those cleats? They're going to use them for like 4 months and I have to buy new cleats. I hate it. All right. Let me know how that goes. And I appreciate you and I understand everything that you're saying and I get it. And recycle those toys. Get them out as quick as they get in. Please, please, please. All right. Next phone call. And I got to tell you, people, if you are from Ontario, listen up, okay? This is an important phone call for all of our friends in Ontario, Canada. Jesse, take it away.
Hi, Paul. This is Jesse calling from Ontario, Canada. It's been a few months since my wife and I submitted dueling voicemails to you regarding our disagreement on the subject matter of installing a pool in the backyard of our home in London, Ontario. My wife, to briefly recap, is pro-pool. I am anti-pool. My wife and I have continued these conversations, haven't really gotten anywhere, haven't made a lot of progress, despite your helpful suggestion to just get a cover and heat the pool, and that would somehow eradicate the 2 feet of snow on top of it most of the year. I'm calling today to provide you a bit of an update. If my wife is listening, that may come as a bit of a surprise, because, as I said, between the two of us, we haven't made a lot of progress, but I've been thinking an awful lot about this, and I think in life, something you can't put a price tag on is your spouse's happiness in life. And I wanted to call and let you know that I've decided to capitulate to my wife's demands and agree to have a pool installed in our house. Now, it's going to take a little time. You know, COVID slowed a lot of things down. Demand has gone up. Supply has gone down. It's probably going to be a year and a half before we get it installed. I wanted to thank you for your advice. As unhelpful as it may have been, it has helped us to come to this resolution. And I'd like you finally to know that somewhere in rural Ontario, there is a mail carrier driving around in her Toyota RAV4, listening to this podcast and screaming in delight at this announcement. Thanks very much.
Oh, damn it. Damn it. Jesse, you're getting a pool. I love it. I absolutely love it. I love that I was not helpful in this decision, but I think I was, because you're getting a goddamn pool. You know what? Life is short. In a year and a half, just make sure that wherever you put this pool, you're going to stay there. I hope you're going to stay there. Don't make sure before you put that pool in the ground that you are committed to being in this house, because that would be the worst. My heart goes out to your wife right now. I think you're going to enjoy it. I think it's going to be great. I think, you know, these are the things that we need to do. We just talked about not spending money, but we talked about the enrichment of your life. And when your spouse wants something, give it to them. We don't have a whole life. We don't know how much time we have. And even if we get a great year in that pool, it's better than no pool for a year. Is that about right? People, I'm writing a self-help book, and that's going to be the chapter. Congratulations, Jesse. Congratulations, Jesse's wife. I'm glad that you're going to enjoy this pool, and I want to see pictures. I want to do everything. And if I ever come to Ontario, I am going to swim in your pool. All right. Thank you, everybody, for your calls. And remember to call us anytime at 619-PAULASK, 619-728-5275. Damn, I'm excited for Jesse and his wife. Ontario, Canada's got a pool. New pool in there. All right. People, I love these songs. You just heard an amazing song from The Conjurer and Teddy Love Supreme. Did I say thank you to Teddy Love Supreme? If I didn't, Teddy Love Supreme did the Paul Helpline song, and that was great. So now I'm throwing down the gauntlet to you. If you want to create your own song for the show, please do it. Any segment of the mini episode, we are looking for themes. Mailbag, helpline, corrections and omissions, etc. You write it, you record it, you send it to howdidthisgetmade@earwolf.com, and we will play it. That's right. Keep it short, keep it sweet, and keep it as good as Teddy Love Supreme or The Conjurer. All right, we'll be right back after this commercial break. All right, people. Now, before we reveal what is coming up next week, we need to go back. We need to go back and talk about the things that we dropped the ball on from last week's episode. So we're turning the show over to you as you tell us some...
corrections conditions. All human reason is in the facts, basically rare to show. Listeners, no one knows.
That's right, corrections and omissions. Thank you, Crew Lies. Crew Lies, it's spelt the French way, Crew. I love Crew Lies and I love that song. People, we've gone on the Discord, the brand new How Did This Get Made Discord, which is discord.gg/htgm. And you also have my Discord, which is discord.gg/Paul Scheer. We're actually doing some live events on the Discord. Maybe I'll even do a live event on How Did This Get Made, but come on over. We'll talk. We'll have a good time. Here's the thing. The Discord has been amazing. We have amazing moderators in both camps. I love the communication. I love the world building. The world building. It's not like Dune, but I just think there's good relationships being made there. And I love these comments because I'm actually able to see a few of them and get in the mix a little bit. So let's go to the Discord right now. I Heart Puffins writes, I am a doctor and I would just like to clarify that the tumor with teeth and hair is usually a teratoma. Now, this is something, by the way, that everyone has brought up to me. I've gotten a lot of people nailing me about this, but let's let the doctor figure it out. Dermoid cysts can contain hair, but usually just comprised of dermal tissues such as skin, oil gland, and sometimes hair follicles. Also, Jason said that a bezoar is from Harry Potter. While I don't know if anything in Harry Potter is called a bezoar, in medicine, a bezoar is a collection of indigestible materials trapped in the stomach, most often when people eat their own hair for years. Oh, God. Of the many patients I have had over the years who have had to have surgery for this, none of them will admit to eating their own hair. Oh, God, this is grossing me out. All of the twin stuff that was said was correct, though. And in one of my pregnancies, my son had a vanishing twin. Maybe he will have a tiny malignant inside of him. No, no. Dr. I Heart Puffins, do not wish that on anyone. I think you guys implied that this happened in parasitic twins only. So, wow. Wow. You just blew my mind, Dr. I Heart Puffins. So much information there. I don't want to eat for a week. Eating their own hair. God damn. All right. Does anyone eat their own hair? Give me a call on the Paul Helpline. Tell me why. You can do it facelessly. We don't see your face. Okay. This is an amazing, by the way, I want to say thank you to everyone who participated in the hashtag MeLignant challenge. You can see all of the ones that I was able to retweet on our Twitter feed. I put some of them on our Instagram feed as well. Y'all did an amazing job. Now, this image that is with this next post, you got to see it on the Discord to believe it. But New Blue Goo has really blown it out here. Similar to Jason's theory, I think that while Gabrielle emerges from the back of Madison's skull, the scalp is split and gets pushed towards the front and side of Madison's face. But also, there's the size and mass of Gabrielle to account for. I think the front of Madison's face probably caves in two, like the face of a spoon. He breaks and dislocates her arms, so why not her jaw and face bones too? A concave face would be much easier to hide with hair and would also explain why Gabrielle's face looks inside out. I don't remember Madison's face ever fully shown while Gabrielle is fully out, and then boom, they show an image of it that, wow, gross. Wow, you guys are taking me down some really the spoon, Madison spoon face. Look, I'm going to just straight up say that Madison would be severely incapacitated if that much of her face and scalp and brain. I mean, I know they're sharing a brain. I don't know. Oh, I don't even want to think about it. Okay, let's go to the phones. I need to clear my head. John from SoCal, what do you got?
Hey, Paul. This is John from Southern California. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm listening to the Malignant episode, and I you just mentioned the whole thing about the jail cell, and I have this theory about why there's like 70s people, and I thought you would have noticed because you're a kid from the 80s as well. Their blender in the kitchen was an old blender, and like there's this weird thing in the, like, some of the appliances in the movie are like old, and then the house is like new, and they're using cell phones. Isn't that all Malignant or whatever the brother's name is, now I'm forgetting. But anyway, isn't that all him creating that projection so that she thinks that she's in the real world? So when he was alive in the late 70s, early 80s or whatever, those are the objects that he would have known existed. So that's why there's this weird mishmash of modern and like late 70s, early 80s references, be it people wearing 70s disco outfits in jail cells or just appliances in the house being old and they're using cell phones. Just thought that was an interesting theory. I don't know if it works or not, but there it is. Take care. Love the show.
Okay. Huh. Hmm. This one kind of stumps me. So you're saying that Malignant, when inside the brain, is controlling everything that she sees, but yet we're not looking at things through her POV. We are seeing things through a neutral point of view, or at least it seems that way. Huh. I like this idea. So this whole movie was seen that way. Now, what would have made that theory work is if the entire hospital changed at the end. I don't know. I think it's a great theory. It's a smart theory, but it doesn't seem to work in any way with the plot. Like, there's nothing in this that would, like, I believe she's a functioning person, I guess is what I'm saying. And so what you're saying is this entire time she's been making Malignant has been making her see. I don't buy it. I like it. I don't buy it. How about that? That's how I land on that one. If anyone disagrees with me or agrees with John, let me know. Let's keep these comments going. Dennis from Missouri.
Hey, Paul. This is Dennis calling from Missouri. I wanted to talk about Malignant. I don't think Malignant is breaking the arms. I think Malignant was dislocating the joints. If you watch, I feel like the arms become kind of floppy. And Malignant has figured out how to use the floppiness to his advantage when killing people. I also want to say that when I was 5 years old, my dad was building our house. I was sitting on what would become the framing for the attic, and I fell out of that about 8 feet to the ground on the concrete, landed on my butt, and was not hurt. No broken bones, no scratches, not even much of a bruise. Thanks for a great show. Keep up the good work. Goodbye.
Wow. Okay, first of all, producer Cody notes that her close friend drove his car off a cliff and had no injuries. The doctors thought he was knocked unconscious somehow before his car drove off the cliff in a very steep hill. And there's something to be said about not being injured when you're floppy. So, I mean, floppy is maybe look, I've always... When I was traveling around, one of the first gigs I had, I was taping different pieces for the show. And I had a DP, a director of photography, who would always scream out one thing whenever we were driving. If we were in a van going to set and someone hit the brake, he would say, "Loosen your body for impact." And it I think about it all the time. Loosen your body for impact, because if you tighten for impact, you will break a bone. So loosen your body for impact is kind of in your theory. And I like your theory that Malignant's kind of doing a little bit of a Riggs from Lethal Weapon, kind of dislocating their shoulders and arms. So I like that idea. I like loose, floppy body. It all works. It all works to me. Dennis, you're a goddamn genius. I like it. I'm not going to clarify anything he said because he said it so perfectly. Back to the Discord, RyRy80 writes, "The performers who play Gabriel / Malignant need a shout out." Yes, RyRy, you are totally right. Both of them have been on America's Got Talent and are amazing contortionists. Troy James and Marina Mazepa, You can look them up on YouTube. There's Marina Mazepa. She has a contortionist dancer, and it says crazier than The Exorcist, and it is amazing. And then Troy James has another video called Freak Out Act. These are wow. Oh my God. All right. The worst thing is a reaction video where you can't see anything, but I'm telling you, you have to check it out. A big, huge shout out to Troy James and Marina Mazepa, who I have to say, the reason why we didn't give them a shout out is I didn't even think there was a person in there. I thought it was a puppet or a CGI. So to know that Maligny, little baby Maligny, was actually played by two amazing performers, just, again, makes me so appreciative of the genius of this movie. Cal 100 writes, there's a small slash useless scene where the sister and mom get Madison's adoption certificate. The mother says something like, you see, I told you there's a reason for not throwing this stuff out. Was she just justifying not throwing away her adopted child's birth certificate? There's no practical use or sentimental value for that. Huh, that's interesting. I mean, well, okay. Well, if I adopted someone, I would keep that adoption certificate, right? That doesn't seem to be, I mean, there is sentiment. You say there's no practical use or sentimental. There is. You adopted someone. That's a moment. That is important. It's not like you need a receipt. You don't need to show it. But look, the things I keep from my kids, I would keep, if I adopted my child, I would keep that certificate because that's like the start of this life. I think that is important. I know that scene is useless and it's weird that she's even justifying it. She's like, oh, of course we have that. Of course we have that because we adopted you. I have a birth certificate. These are the things that we keep. We disagree, but we agree. Okay. We just disagree. So many great corrections and omissions this week, but there can only be one winner. And I think we all know that winner is our doctor. That's right. Dr. I Heart Puffins, who opened our minds and eyes to one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard. People who eat hair and then have to have surgery to get that hair removed, but yet will not admit that they eat hair. Oh, God damn. Yikes. Thank you for implanting this terrible, terrible image in my head. And I will now tell it to everyone I know to make sure that they never eat their own hair. Oh, I'm even thinking about eating hair. I'm getting so grossed out. Oh, you know, just play the theme. Thank you, Francis Day. That's right, Dr. I Heart Puffins. You are our winner. You get nothing, but you will forever hold a place in my heart, and you will have burned in a special spot into my brain because I can never let that go. We'll be right back after this with Ed Brubaker and more. Jason, we are bringing on one of our special guests from How Did This Get Made? I would consider him a How Did This Get Made all-star. He is also an multi-award-winning graphic novelist who has so many credits to his name, but I would say you might know him as the person behind creating Winter Soldier, the person behind the amazing series Gotham PD, but more importantly, the series of things that he's been doing that I've been loving so much lately have been his independent books. They have been absolutely great. I know you and I are both a fan of this guy.
Big time. Big time. And they have been a central part of my pandemic reading, has been a tremendous amount of this gentleman's books and his continuing partnership with the artist Sean Phillips.
Yes. So we're talking about books like Fatale, Velvet, The Fade Out, Criminal, Killer Be Killed, Pulp. And the book that we're going to be talking a lot about today is Reckless, which is, I think, right up you and our alley. Please welcome.
Oh, yeah.
Ed Brubaker. Ed, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me. I watched every movie I could possibly think of that we might talk about. And then, are we still doing Die Hard 4?
Yes.
By the way, I've told Ed has a bad movie night or a celebration of bad movies. And I told Ed that if, you know, it's not complete until he gets Governor Gabby in that night. Have you been able to find it yet, Ed?
Well, yeah, you sent me the link.
Okay, guys. Now, so, oh, so, yeah, maybe we should.
Wait, I think everyone will have to watch it on their phones. It is impossible to find in any other way, shape, or form.
Yes. So you've seen it all.
It is worth it. I can't recommend that movie highly enough. If you are into bad movies, that is a great bad one.
I want to. How will it stack up against Nicole Kidman's wonderful performance in BMX Bandits from 1983?
oh my God. BMX Bandits and The Legend of Billie Jean are kind of inextricably linked to me.
Yeah.
Ed, the last two times we had you on for Daredevil and then The Phantom.
Yeah,
and both really fun episodes. But today we are going to be talking more about the work that you do, because Jason and I really just wanted to geek out with you a little bit. Specifically because
comics talk, Ed. We're doing comics talk for you.
How did this comic get made?
There it is.
Yeah.
How did
this comic get written and drawn?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we all have talked about this. Ed, you and I have talked about this. Jason and I, we've talked about this. Jason grew up, you love Magnum, right? That was your like kind of entry into the private detective.
Not only was Magnum like my favorite TV show growing up, in the pandemic, I have rewatched almost all of Magnum PI, the series.
Wow.
Oh my God. Wow.
Like, I have rewatched the entirety of it. And it is, and I will say, aside from certain kind of elemental things like how slowly TV moved back then and certain things like that, it really remains a very compelling show. It is
Remember the one where he's like lost at sea and remembering his
treading
whole childhood?
Water. That is one of the most amazing. That is a top five episode of television for me. Treading Water episode of Magnum PI, the Buffy the Vampire episode called Hush. Like there are certain singular episodes that to me are incredible, and that is one of them. And it is absolutely like incredible on a rewatch. So do yourself a favor.
That's next on my list. I have watched all of Rockford twice through.
So good.
Murder, She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote.
My wife got really into rewatching Murder, She Wrote. I'd never watched it before. I'm friends with Chris Levinson, whose dad was the co-creator of Columbo and Murder, She Wrote. And so I got some behind the scenes talk about Murder, She Wrote, which just made me really want to watch it.
I've been rewatching Columbo as well.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I love Columbo. I was going to say Rockford was a big staple for me, but like Murder, She Wrote falls into that category of shows that I don't even think were shot. Like, you know, it's like when you said like, oh, behind the scenes, I'm like, oh, right, those are actors. Like, it feels different. Like, it was when I watched it when I was naive and I didn't understand that there was like television and she had contracts and this is a successful show. Like, it's funny how those certain shows like feel
separate.
There was
a period of my childhood where Magnum PI and Murder, She Wrote were back-to-back shows on Sunday night on CBS.
They ruled.
And that was and the A-Team and Dukes of Hazzard were on Friday night, and Magnum PI and Murder, She Wrote were on Sunday night. It was like the greatest. And the Carol Burnett Show and the Muppets were on Sunday.
Oh my gosh.
Well.
Oh
my
By the
God,
way,
the Carol Burnett Show,
If you like Incredible. Murder, She Wrote, I don't even know where it's on, but Mapleworth Murders.
I can tell you.
Okay, yeah.
I can tell you. And this is for people who have cable, because Magnum PI and Murder, She Wrote air two episodes per day on Hallmark Murders and Mysteries.
Oh, wow.
A sub Hallmark channel called Hallmark Murders and Mysteries, which all of the in-between commercials, because it's regular television, there are commercials, are absolutely hilarious. I watch the commercials just because they're advertising shows that are like premiering this Sunday, season 11 of, and then some TV show you've never heard of that is basically like Murder, She Wrote for Now, starring Andy McDowell. And like, there's a million of there's one about like there's one about witches that run like that looks like they run like an Airbnb or something like that. It's fucking bananas.
I mean, there's so many of these shows. I was saying though that there's an what Paul Appel did this show called Mapleworth Murders, which is like a parody of Murder, She Wrote, produced by like Seth Meyers, and it starred like John Lutz and J.B. Smoove. And it was on Quibi, which now I guess means it's on Roku. But I did watch that and it's very, very funny. And yeah, and it's
Check that out.
Every episode's 10 minutes. So I think,
ooh, that's fun.
You know, so I think that there's basically like four cases, total, you know, they're very quick. But that being said, what I think really all your books, bring me in, I'm on board, but Reckless was a book that immediately captured my attention because it lives in this same kind of cool detective noir world. We're talking a lot about 80s
it's got
too.
It's got a very Shaggy, The Long Goodbye,
yes,
Big Lebowski, Los Angeles Shaggy detective story. It takes place in the 80s. And, you know, you get me, Ed, the minute you have the main character lives and works out of a dilapidated movie theater.
I mean, it's one of best. It's one of the best things. And like
that's it.
And he got the movie theater because he did a job for someone like some real estate mogul who just happened to be like, oh, yeah, take this building. And it's the perfect setup. It is. I just love him in the balcony watching movies. And the character as drawn by the great Sean Phillips is looks to me like the most badass version of Robert Redford that you would ever see. Like this is like 3 Days of the Condor, Robert Redford, but a little bit more jacked. You know, there's an energy to him that is, I love this character. I'm like, do one of those face apps?
He's a little bit Steve McQueen, a little bit Redford, more of like a surfer vibe.
Yeah.
You know, because he's a surfer. He's a Venice, he's like Venice Beach Robert Redford, kind of, existed, I'm sure. But
it's a series of books that you're putting out that are, each one is a case that this character is, you know, kind of goes into the, you know, it's like they're traditional noir, pulpy kind of noir type stories, private detective type stories. And I know for you, like, that's a real sweet spot, both in Criminal and in many of your other books. Like, there is I feel like you are frequently riffing off of those classic, you know, Philip Marlowe kind of detective story, you know, noir detective stories.
Yeah, I definitely come out of that school of like pulp paperbacks, and like the Parker books were a huge influence on me, and Ross McDonald's like Lou Archer mysteries sort of taught me how to write, I feel like. I was about to start a monthly comic book series that was going to be like really dark and dealing with a lot of stuff that I thought it was going to be like so timely and perfect. And, you know, but as I started getting ready to work on it, the whole world like locked down and the comics industry shut down. And I just was reading like old pulp paperbacks all the time. And I just thought, I want to do something like this instead. That'll be more fun. And I didn't even realize until I started jotting down notes on who this character was, like, I had a whole lifetime of ideas for a character like this, like, because I almost never do a good guy. We're always like, I'm always doing like the good bad guy, like he's a thief, but he's got like, you know, he's like got a moral compass, but he'll also murder people to get away. And I wanted to do a good guy character because I was, for the first time ever, I was reading the Travis McGee books, which were my dad's favorites. And
over a pandemic well. I read like two of them and I love them. They're so good.
They were so far ahead of their time, which is really weird because they were behind their times on how sexist they are, which fit, which fit really well in with the times of like James Bond novels or whatever. But they're way ahead of their time on like, he's like an environmentalist. And it's like 1962, and he's talking about like the oil, you know, like how they're wrecking the wetlands in Florida. And like every book, there's something about how we're fucking up the environment in it. And this is like the 60s. And I was like, it's weird. You're so far ahead on the environmental stuff. And yet every woman he meets, you know, the description is basically, does he want to bang her or not? And I'm like, holy God. But but I really wanted to do something in that field. That's why the covers for the books look like those old like paperback books that you'd see on the spinner rack at like the Pick and Save or, you know, the Fed Mart or whatever in the 70s, like where they had like book 76 of The Executioner. So I wanted to do something that felt like it came out of that world, but with like our more modern sensibility and get rid of all the sexism and, you know, but still have that kind of slightly over the top guy takes a case. He will murder people if he feels that they deserve it. And he is, you know, this guy who's, he's got a little bit of brain damage. So he has trouble relating to people. And it's very LA in the 80s kind of thing, which I felt was just a lot of fun to try to escape back into the past and be able to talk a little bit about what the world's going through right now, or by remembering like all the warnings we had from like the 70s onward about global warming or the way corporations will just do whatever, or, you know, there's like so much societal rot that we can look back at and see the ripples that came all the way through to today. And I just thought, this will be fun. I'll, you know, I started making a list. I'm like, he drives a cool van. He lives in a movie theater that he works out of. He's got an 800 number, like the Equalizer or something. And
yeah,
you know, his sidekick is like the super cool punk runaway girl. And, you know, like, cause you have to have certain elements to make it fit in with the genre.
Yeah.
But I thought they were going to just be super easy and fun to do. And they'd be these over the top violent things. And then as I started working on them more and more, as usual, I just made it harder and harder for us. And I spent an hour this morning trying to find a good picture of like a gas station from 1988 in Los Angeles. I was like, because gas pumps looked different then, you know, it's like everything about like if you drive through LA and you can probably find like three gas stations that haven't been updated since 1988. But most of them are like completely different now and a different name. So it's like I'm always trying really hard to make sure, at least because on the page, it costs nothing to recreate. You know, it cost Tarantino $50 million to recreate, you know, 70s L.A.
Totally.
But, you know, for on paper, it's the same as blowing up the Death Star. You know, it's like so I'm always trying to get as much photo reference and include in the next book. Book four, I actually have a scene at the original Okie Dog, which was a very big punk rock hangout in the late 70s, early 80s.
Oh,
but is
that
at a different location now. And it's nearly impossible to find pictures of the original one anymore. And so
can I ask you a quick question, like on a process level, like is a huge part of it not just writing these scripts but finding photo references to send to Sean? Are you creating like a lookbook for every, or just a folder of pictures for every issue that is like the van should be like these vans, or like are you creating something, or are you writing stuff and just getting back from Sean pages and are like, oh yeah, that's it, you know?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, on when we did the Fade Out, which was our like late 40s Hollywood thing, I actually had an assistant that I hired to help collate this thing. We ended up with this files and subfiles with like 10 or 20,000 photos of like LA in the 40s and like high school yearbooks and all sorts of stuff, just to see what regular people looked like and what the neighborhoods looked like. But we would also end up like needing something that we couldn't find. And so you dig through, and it's much easier to find online like reference photos from like the 40s and 50s because people are like, hey, look how cool it looked back then. No one cared about the 80s.
Right.
Like, no, like you, but yeah, I do. It's like Sean does a bunch of it himself. And sometimes though, because he's from England, he lives in the Lake District in England, which is where like Beatrix Potter lived. So everything he has to draw is all like, well, I don't know what that looks like. I mean, I when we started doing the first one, I would just send the odd photo, like, here's what a gas station looked like in 1985 or 1981, or here's, you know, here's the street the movie theater should be on, and you know, change this building into something else. And like, I do a bit of that. And then he was doing a lot of it. And I sent them, him and his son, Jake, is our colorist. And I sent them photos from like old 70s movies, like Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, or just to get the colors, like Terrence Malick movies and stuff. Yeah. Cause I was like, this is what cause they'd been to California recently, but I'm like, California didn't look like that in the 70s and 80s. It was green and blue.
Do they like this, by the way? Like, do they like you sending them pages and pages of research photos? Do you, like, I mean, do you feel like they're like,
I never have asked. I assume it's helpful.
I mean, you guys have an amazing collaboration, so I'm sure it's good, but I wonder, like,
I think it is. Well, sometimes it's like when you describe something in a script, you're not sure if the other person understands what the thing is that you're saying, but with like specific locations, like I'm trying to make this thing feel like if you live in LA, like I don't want to have a character driving from Silver Lake to Santa Monica and taking the wrong streets or be driving the wrong way. I'm
right.
No, they're going west on Santa Monica. They have to go under the 405. Like
they're driving into the sun.
There's pages of the book that are just like, it's almost like that thing on Saturday Night Live where it's like, how do you get there? Like the Californians, where it's like, there's a scene in book one that describes how he actually drove from Los Angeles up to like the Willits area.
Yeah.
Like what highways he took and how he cut across on the street that on the highway James Dean died on, and then went up the 101 the rest of the way. And it's like, it's such a LA thing to me, because having lived in LA for like 10 or 12 years, like that's such a part of your life. Is like, how do you get there? Like there's a big scene in the third book about how fucked it is because someone's going to move from Venice to Los Feliz, and it's like, oh, I'll never fucking see you.
That's
you're done. Like, you might as well be moving to another state.
we did something on the show when we did Escape from LA, the John Carpenter sequel to Escape from New York. We either had somebody, a listener on the show, made a map of the locations that they hit, and it was the most ass backwards map. Like the snake could have never have gotten to all these spots. And so I do appreciate that like,
I try. I mean, occasionally I will fudge it just to get a cool location into a background or something, but I try really hard to have it somewhat, to make it as much sense. Cause I don't want to, like, I remember when I was watching Singles and I lived in Seattle at the time, and I'm like, why is she riding from downtown to Capitol Hill, but going through Fremont? I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. I wrote an article for like Birth Movies Death once complaining about The Killing, because I was like, she drove right by her house on her way to the place that she got out of the car eventually. Like the pedantic dick about it. I was like, just look at a map.
What do you think? Like, obviously you are, you know, you've lived in this world and you know these stories, and especially when you're writing something like this, like what are things that you're avoiding or things that you don't like? Like you don't have to name like from the specific show, but besides location-based gaffes, like are there certain like tropes that you, and sexism, like are there certain tropes that you kind of try to get away from or that you see overused and stuff like that?
You know, I really never think about that stuff when I'm working on it too much. Right. When I'm writing the story, like I figure there's only so many like mystery stories you can do. So much of it for me is just like, what will this character do in this situation? Like the situations are always fairly straightforward and, you know, rely on like the noir cliches, but the it's the way the characters react and the things that the characters are thinking about and their relationships that really end up driving the narrative so much that I kind of feel like the second book is, you know, about Ethan, our star character Ethan is like wallowing in misery after his dad died, and he's like buying all these old like 16mm TV shows from like the 50s and 60s that he grew up watching with his dad because he wants to sort of remember the good old days. And then he takes a case and meets a girl at the public library and starts dating her. And then he happens to stumble across like this. He's showing her like this weird movie he's never seen before. That's like a drive-in movie from the 70s. And it turns out her sister, who's been missing for 8 years that he never even knew about, is in the background of one of the scenes. And then that sends him on this case to try to find this girl who's been missing in the LA film scene for like 8 years. And I just, you know, it's like, if you just took it, what he's actually doing straight right. through, it's, you know, it's just like a case from the Rockford Files or any murder mystery book. It's like, oh, this girl's missing. We'll track down her last, you know, it's like traditional mystery structure in a way. But the way that I told the story was much more about like how it made Ethan feel, because he could tell early on how the case was going to end and how it was going to just destroy this relationship that he yeah. was actually enjoying. And
that's so, what I love about this book. And that's what I love about a lot of your books, is that kind of the main character's understanding of the stakes of what's happening. And right. the likelihood is that this is not going to end well. You yeah. know, like this story, even though these are a new, unique set of circumstances, I know how these stories end. And those are, you know, usually the kind of done in, you know, in movies and in TV shows with that private investigator voiceover, that kind
yeah,
of,
right.
yeah,
that
exactly.
kind of, we're all doomed kind of voiceover that tells you, I'm going to keep moving forward. And the story is so fascinating to watch as it unfolds.
Yeah.
But, you know, he always knows that at the end of this, his happiness will be lost. The yeah. new love he'll find through giving her closure on
right.
yeah, this case. Exactly.
He will lose her. Or I feel like one of the, to not to jump off of Reckless, but to just use as an example, one of my favorite things that you've done, because it's unfolded over so many years, is like how generational the Lawless family in the criminal books,
yeah.
like the generational traumas and difficulties of these fathers to sons. I feel like you write a lot about fathers and sons.
Yeah.
And
which is funny, because I had a really good relationship with my dad. I think I a lot of people always assume I had a bad relationship with my dad or something. I was like, no, I had a bad relationship with my mom. I just flip it in the books.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I feel like your dads are so deeply flawed
yeah.
and so deeply, they cause so much trauma and physical abuse and mental abuse for oftentimes their sons. And you write such kind of almost incredibly like Velvet or the woman in Fatal, like you write these female characters who are not that yeah. not, you know, who are, you know, almost paragons of they are so adept, and they are taking care of business, they're kick-ass, they're doing all
yeah.
this amazing stuff, and it's the fathers who are these kind of fucking assholes, you know.
Well, yeah, I will. I mean, Teague Lawless, especially from the criminal books, is
yeah. you
know, he's like a guy who comes home from Vietnam with PTSD. And like, I remember, like, when I was a little kid, one of the first memories I have of my dad is when he returned from Vietnam, because he came back for when I was born, and then he went back to Vietnam because he was Navy intelligence over there. So he was over there for like 3 or 4 years.
Speaking of Magnum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which I will say, there is a tremendous, it's so interesting to me, there are a tremendous amount of mid-80s TV shows, Magnum P.I., The A-Team, are grappling with the generation of men who've come home from Vietnam and don't know what to do
yeah.
and are lost and are
yeah.
and are grappling with what they did and what they saw. Like, so much of Magnum P.I., having just watched it, is yes, about a handsome playboy private investigator in Hawaii, but a tremendous amount of it is about Vietnam, flashbacks, yeah. PTSD.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize they would go that deep, because I always felt
they
like
they go back to rescue prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Like it's Vietnam is a constant issue for TC, Rick, and Magnum. Constant.
Yeah. It was, I mean, up until the late 80s, you know, older friends of mine would still talk to you about that time when their draft number came up and they had to decide whether they were going to like go or flee the country or how they got lucky and they drew like a big number so they weren't ever picked. And like, I knew people, like people who mentored me in comics and stuff who actually dealt with all that. And, but I remember, you know, like, cause I grew up and, you know, I'm a Navy brat. So like I moved from Gitmo to San Diego when I was like 7 years old. And I remember seeing like the first like homeless vets on the street and stuff. And yeah, it was definitely like a theme. Like homelessness now is on a whole other scale. And I don't know how many of those are veterans. I'm sure a lot of them are veterans from the Gulf Wars and, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's just this part of it that I really, you know, like in Reckless, especially when I got to that, which is like the reason he as a teenager goes right from being like the teenage son of a Navy intel guy to working for the FBI and being like an undercover hippie in the Weather Underground movement was because, you know, his dad didn't want him to go to Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, and right, yeah, this kid raised on military bases, so he didn't know anything. And then he got over there and a couple of years into this, he's kind of like, hey, I'm on the other side, actually. And yeah, but then he's in too deep. So it was like, I had thought of that for a character for a long time, because when I was reading about all the FBI infiltration and COINTELPRO, I really wanted to do something about someone who'd lived through that. And having that be part of Ethan's backstory was like, he's sort of out of that student movement, Watergate, you know. I mean, when you go back and you do research, you can find newspapers from, especially like you can find a Santa Cruz newspaper that's like about surfers finding dead bodies on like in the shore. Wow. Of like serial killer. Yeah, there was three serial killers operating in Santa Cruz at the same time. Timothy Leary being broken out of jail, Watergate, and then buildings being blown up in San Francisco. Like this will all be like one front page. And you're like, holy shit, a lot of shit was happening back then.
Well, we were just talking about this, like in the sense of I just seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre and part of that was coming out of this idea of like, you know, this peace and love movement there, but yet the world is kind of starting to crumble around them. That's this idea of the, you know, certain things were closing off to people. Other people were not understanding why there was so much violence around it. It really is interesting how much it got into the work. And I would say that we're in a very parallel situation right now. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of just discontentment across the board. But I think what is always so interesting about these books ultimately is you have so much time to really allow the weight of the character's backstory to like live with them. And now hearing that Magnum did it, I'm surprised, but it's like this idea that you can actually, well, every episode continue, you know, it's like it's not like, okay, we solved that mystery, now we're back clean slate. It's like, no, everything like leaves a little bit of a mark.
I just recently watched an episode of Magnum where you see, but in the course of the episode, both Magnum and TC are having PTSD flashbacks to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, I think Magnum says to TC, or maybe TC says to Magnum, hey, do you ever think about it? You know, back there, what we did, and do you ever think about it? And the other says, no, never. So yeah, they don't even share it with you. They don't even share their traumas with each other. They just keep them inside. And as the seasons go on, it just gets more and more of it. Like, it really remains such a prevalent part of their stories is that period of time they spent in Vietnam. And that is, for a TV show that is ostensibly yachts and Ferraris and, you know,
right,
you know, Magnum has to protect this statue from being stolen by this, you know, all of the hallmarks of, you know, that kind of a, you know, Playboy style PI show, for it to be like suffused with this deep, dark melancholy and these very uncomfortable flashbacks is kind of incredible, you know, that they were doing that.
I actually lived in Hawaii for ninth grade. My dad, after he got out of the military, worked for like a military contractor, and he moved over there, and my brother stayed at my mom's, and I moved with my dad because I thought it'll be fun to live in Hawaii. And, you know, it wasn't actually that fun. to be in ninth grade in Hawaii. But
were you an outcast there?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, I was one of five Howleys in my school. It was not a fun experience. I learned how to ditch school. I discovered punk rock because Rock and Roll High School was on HBO every day. And I would ditch school because these Samoans would wait for me outside of the typing class to beat me up before typing class like three times a week. And so I just started ditching school at lunch and walking home. And you still
can't type.
Yeah, it took me forever to learn how to type because of that. When I lived there, I never saw a single person who looked like Magnum P. I know there were no guys walking around in like a Hawaiian shirt and dolphin shorts.
Right, right.
It always cracked me up. And I remember people on the island, my friend's aunt had like a farm and someone from Magnum had come to location scout it and didn't film there. And she was like, who cares about that show anyway? And I'm like, well, you know, like 90% of America, apparently it's watched by like 40 million people a week.
I mean, that's the other thing too. Incredible. Like these shows were watched by everyone. Just so people know, and we are talking about Reckless, the book three.
About Magnum PI.
Yeah. This is our Magnum cast. Book three comes at that would be our spinoff podcast as we just go through Magnum. Jason, you lead us through.
By the way, I just did it.
I could do it. I told you, Paul, I wanted to do the Rockford Files.
Yeah.
Just me and a guest like watch Rockford in order. You can do it. It's all on the Peacock now.
Yeah.
The Peacock has Rockford. They have all the Columbos, including the first two, and a 90-minute long.
That one, the IRA one, the IRA Columbo one.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's like a movie. Weird. It's adapted from an Ed McBain novel where he goes to like a wedding and he pulls a gun on someone and shoots someone. I'm like, Columbo shot somebody?
I work with Kate Mulgrew on NTSF SDSUV and she was Mrs. Columbo.
Mrs. Columbo, yeah.
Which was the spinoff of Columbo.
People who created Columbo were so mad about it that they had to like yank that show and retitle it as something else. It ended up being called Kate and the Detective.
Yeah, I think it was called Kate the Detective.
Yeah, Kate the Detective.
Then it was called Kate Loves a Mystery.
Yeah, Kate Loves a Mystery. And they changed her last name because the Levinson and Link were like not consulted and were against it. And they were like, oh no, we will never make more Columbo if you keep doing this to us.
I mean,
that's interesting.
They gave her a divorce.
Like 12 when they got married.
Yes.
If you look at, because in the early Columbos, he talks about having been married for like 20 years. And she was like 25 when that show started or something.
I mean, well, like, so Kate Mulgrew right now, just according, like, is in her mid-60s, right? So if you look at, like, how old Peter Falk would have been, I mean, that would have been a very bizarre marriage. Yeah, but I mean, that's TV. I think,
TV. But I mean, it was realistic for the 70s.
he died at 83 in 2011. So he would have been 90. So she's mid-60s and he would be mid-90s right now. Like, that was a 30-year age gap.
The saddest thing, too, he during the last years of his life, couldn't even remember that there was that he'd ever played a character called Columbo. His dementia was so far gone, apparently.
By the way, I know we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but Mike and Nikki, Elaine May is a great Peter Falk. I mean, not a Columbo thing, but a Peter Falk performance that is phenomenal.
Oh, man. Yes. Yeah. All the stuff he did with Cassavetes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's why Columbo was on so seldom, actually, was because he wanted to keep making all the weird art films with Cassavetes and stuff. He didn't want to do like 20 episodes a year. That's why Columbo, when I was a kid, it was like my parents before they got divorced. It was a big deal. Oh, Columbo's going to be on because Columbo was only on like once every 3 months.
It felt like a movie coming out in the theaters.
And some of them are movie length. You know,
a lot of them are 90 minutes.
They were like,
or movies, longer.
They were basically movies of the week style episodes.
They had a thing. It was like a Thursday night thing on, was it CBS, one of those channels, NBC. I can't remember which one they were on, but it was them. The there was one with Rock Hudson and somebody where they were like a husband and wife solving crimes, and there was McCloud. Well,
but what about,
McCloud, yeah.
What do you
yeah.
think? I mean, everyone's been talking about it, Jason. They've all been saying, you know, that Jesse Stone is the rightful successor to Magnum. You know, Tom Selleck now doing these Jesse Stone stories every week on CBS or occasionally.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, okay. So Jesse Stone is Tom Hanks's detective character based on...
Wait, Tom Hanks?
Oh, sorry. No. Tom Selleck.
Okay,
Selleck.
I was like, whoa.
Yeah, Tom Hanks is back on TV stealthily.
So he's playing a new detective character? This is not Blue Bloods.
No.
Series of books, I think.
By Robert Parker, see. Robert Parker wrote a bunch of books.
Oh, they're Parker books.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. By the guy who did Spencer for Hire.
So this is his new thing.
Oh, got it.
So he pops up a lot with these Jesse Stone.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to check that out. Okay. I will, while we're talking about Parker, I will just shout out the Darwin Cook Parker adaptations that I think are absolutely some of the best comics done in the last 50 years.
Yeah. I don't know. That was part of my inspiration for starting for doing Reckless the way we did as graphic novels, because I have been, Sean designed it, but after Darwin passed away, we volunteered to sort of help sort of present the, they do these martini editions of those where they collect two of them with all these extras and stuff. And so I was like, there's nothing I can do. Can I help like put this book together and help edit the book and do something for this book and help you promote it, to just sort of get his work out there to help curate it? And so I went back and I read all those books again. And the next one comes out like early next year, I think.
Truly, he's the best. And I will also now use this as a segue to talk with you about your work with Darwin Cook on Catwoman.
Oh, yeah.
Is, again, if you like crime stories, I feel like, and, you know, I don't want to tell you what you were thinking, but these are, you know, I feel like you using Catwoman to tell your style of crime caper stories, but with DC characters.
Yeah.
And Darwin draws at least volume one.
Yeah,
he drew the first one.
Yeah, I conned him into drawing the first one because we were redesigning the character, and we just really hit it off talking about old crime novels and stuff. And but yeah, that was amazing. We just kind of lucked into that. Everything, I think if you look at almost everything that I did in superhero comics, I was either doing a crime story that had superheroes in it or an espionage story that had, like, my Captain America run is as much influenced by like Le Carre or like even the show 24, as it is, you know, super old superhero comics, because I really wanted to get that feel of like, oh, a government agent, there's all sorts of SHIELD in it everywhere. And, you know, and that stuff has been, I'm told, really influential on those movies. So,
well, I mean, I was actually having a conversation with somebody this week, and unbeknownst to them, that we're friends, they started talking about Gotham PD and how much they have been trying to chase down and make Gotham PD for such a long time. And it was so interesting. Like, this is somebody that I've never talked comics with or anything, and was such a giant fan of that. Like, it's interesting to see, like, oh, wow, people really have found their own books and know different things about, you know, it's interesting to see how your tentacles have kind of gone.
Yeah, that one has a really long, like, shelf life for people. Like, people are still discovering Gotham Central, and I'm always amazed, when I meet somebody in Hollywood and that's one of their reference points. And I was like, we were so, like, Greg Rucka and I just wanted to write The Cops because we thought...
Yeah.
Because there's no way to make Batman scary when you're hanging out with Batman all the time and you're in his head all the time. It's like, but Batman's super scary if you're a cop and you show up and like Mr. Freeze kills your partner by freezing him in a block of ice and then shattering it. It's like, oh, that's terrifying. And you can't even solve that case. You need this fucking masked guy that you have to turn a light on the roof. It's like, how demoralizing to be those cops. But yeah, we really, I mean, we spent like 4 years working on that book, and I'm still, you know, I mean, they're just doing a new definitive collection of it where I finally got them to, there was always a misprint. They left out a layer of snow in one of our issues of the Joker storyline where he kills everybody, where he like kills the mayor and,
yeah,
and is like messing up Gotham in general. There was this whole sequence where they left out all the overlays of the snow. So people are holding out their hands going, wow, it's really coming down, and there's nothing there. So it drove us crazy. God. No one else ever noticed, but my friend is now the editor in chief at DC. So I just asked her if we could finally fix it. Cause they always told us, oh, there's no way to fix it. And I was like, I'm pretty sure we can fix it.
Yeah. At this point you can do it.
Now technology is like, it took 5 minutes to fix.
Are you also this was announced. They are putting out an omnibus of the Catwoman stuff.
I think they're doing that, and they're doing a new Gotham Central one. They don't really consult us on these things, but I just see them when they get announced. And then I'm like, oh, Gotham, cool.
And these are, I will say to this, if, you know, to the people who are listening, these are both books that are accessible to everybody,
yes,
even if you are not a superhero comics, you know, nerd from back in the day, even if you didn't grow up reading. I think what's great about the Catwoman stuff is these are crime stories, and you understand the architecture and the archetypes that are being used. And Gotham Central is, these are police stories, you know, and it's not unlike, I've been rereading Astro City recently, which is just such a wonderful story.
Marvel's and Astro City were big influences on for me, at least, on Gotham Central, because I liked the like ground level view of these things that are happening, where it's
the
like
human, the human stories about people whose lives are lived inside of a world in which there's a Batman, in which there's a Mr. Freeze.
I never understood you know, why there wasn't an Astro City TV show. Like, it just,
they've tried a few times.
Okay. Yeah. And by the way, if just to talk about it, because Reckless obviously has, the three books have come out within the last
10 months,
which is crazy. Yeah. And it follows up.
And these are big, these are not like,
no,
single
like
issue comics.
Page.
These are, exactly.
And they're all complete stories. It's not like a trilogy. I'm working on the fourth one now. They're all about 100. I sort of modeled them after how long Darwin did the Parker books, because I thought, okay, I can fit this much story in, you know, based on what he did. And, you know, I always wish I had 20 more pages, but we have deadlines.
Right.
But I had this crazy idea, because if we were going to switch to just going straight to graphic novels, I didn't want all the retailers who love our books and, you know, have been supporting us for almost 20 years now as a team to not have stuff to sell. And I just thought, we'll put out the first one in December, we'll put out the second one in April, there'll only be a couple months in between, and then we'll put out the third one in October. We're doing two next year. And I just really wanted to try to get them out quickly. Luckily, Sean is the most reliable artist in comics, I think, at this point. And I think we killed ourselves getting the first three done in that span of time. It took us about a year and 3 months or 4 months to do all of them. We had enough.
And you're watching all the Rockfords, and you're watching and you're reading all this stuff.
And you're reading all of this stuff. One of the things that I want to say for people who are going to seek out your work, one of my absolute favorite parts of your books is, especially in issues, is at the back of every Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips book, Criminal, Fatal, The Fade Out, is an essay that is usually about a movie, a book, a character that has informed this story. So if it's Fatal, there'll be an essay about H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
Or if it's, you know, and those essays are just chock full of references, things that have inspired you, you know, authors, movies, and you have sent me on so many, you know, journeys to read or watch or, you know, all this stuff that is like really so informative, both in experiencing your stuff, but also like so enriching in terms of what I'm consuming. So like, I can't recommend enough that people,
you'll go down a giant rabbit hole and you'll find what you like.
Those are in the single issues, like the backups. I probably only wrote about 10% of them, and a lot of them are written by like Kim Morgan, who co-wrote the new Nightmare Alley with Guillermo del Toro, actually. Just a lot of like movie critic friends, or Patton Oswalt wrote one. He turned everybody in the world onto Blast of Silence, I think, which is one of my favorite movies ever made, and like Scorsese's favorite movie that he saw growing up, I think. And that's the one thing about going from the single issues to the graphic novels that I miss, and that I get complaints from our readers about, like, well, now I'm not getting these. But I'm like, but you don't get to the end of a novel and have a bunch of articles by friends of Raymond Chandler about other things. But I do, I have been coming up with some plans for a way to sort of do, maybe collect some of the old ones and put some new ones out, and some, do some kind of big, like research magazine kind of thing, but like about noir. Like, I think it would be cool to do like a once a year, like, you know, $10 big, like Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips's noir magazine.
Yeah. It really is fun because it gives you so much more. If you've loved this book, it gives you so much more stuff to discover that you will also love. And I really appreciate.
One of my favorite things that ever happened at a signing early on, and when I was still probably in the first 10 issues of Criminal, me and Brian Bendis did a signing in New York at Jim Hanley's Universe. And one of the kids in line was John Turturro's son. And my article about Out of the Past had gotten them to watch Out of the Past, and John Turturro had never seen Out of the Past and became obsessed with Robert Mitchum after that. And they were like listening to the Mitchum Sings Calypso album. And I like emailed back and forth with John Turturro for a little while, which was just a blast. But just the idea that, like, here's one of my favorite actors who had never seen a movie until he read the article in the back of an issue of Criminal, which I was just like, holy shit.
How is that possible? I love that. And
that's awesome.
And I know we have to wrap up, but I will say I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention also Pulp, which just has come out fairly recently as well, and is a great, a tonally different, really amazing book. And you were saying at that point, like, this is like your best-selling book, right? Or is Pulp your
best? Pulp and The Fade Out, I think, are our best-selling things we've ever done, both of which are old, which are period pieces, which most people would think would not be big sellers. But Pulp is sort of it's part Western and part Depression era crime story about like a guy who was kind of like a Butch Cassidy era, like because you know, you had like Billy the Kid and those guys, like
the end
earlier.
Of the Cowboys.
The days of Cowboys when cars were coming in and when the Pinkertons were really hunting people down. And it's about a guy like that who survived and then later in life writes pulp stories that are fictionalized versions of his true story. And it takes place around the same time as that big American Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden that, you know, there's been documentaries about and stuff. And that was just one. Sean wanted to do a Western, and that was as close as I could get. It's about an old man who
oh, so that's interesting. So it came from Sean.
He wanted to do a Sean, Western. And there's like eight pages of Western in it. And then it's all just like this old man.
But you want more of it. So you guys write the Western stuff so fun. It really is great. And that's a one shot, right?
That went to print the day that everything shut down, including the printer and the distributor. So it just sat there for months. And we started working on Reckless because I was like, well, I don't know if the market's going to open up, but we'll just start these graphic novels and we'll do one twice as long as Pulp. And I really, when I was working on it, thought no one would like Pulp or that it wouldn't be a thing anyone cared about. And then it came out right after comic stores opened again. And I was hearing from, you know, some of our big retailers, they were selling, you know, 300 or 400 copies of it the week it came out. And I was like, holy shit, this is a huge hit. We printed enough to last, I thought, a year or two, and we sold out in a little under 6 weeks. And now the paperback has gone through 3 printings, and it won the Eisner for best graphic novel. And we've had a shit ton of Hollywood interest in it. And, yeah, it was a huge surprise. Every time I think everybody's going to hate whatever the book it is, because I always have that moment right yeah. before it comes out where I'm like,
sure,
I'm so close to it. Like, is this good or did I fuck this up? Or, you know, and then if you look online ever, like, I don't have social media, thank God, but I do have like email that people can send me. And it's always that like one person who's nitpicking the thing that gets under there because they're seeing that one thing you hope no one would notice.
Right. Yeah.
But then I'm like, yeah, but you know, like Joe Hill liked it and Patton Oswalt liked it.
Yeah. You can't get caught up in that. All right. So, Ed,
well, but just because we're wrapping up, I know we have to go. I do want to shout out as well. I know we talked a lot about your collaboration today with Sean Phillips, but you are also doing a book, a digital only book with one of my favorite artists, Marcos Martin, called Friday.
Yeah.
That's available on Panel Syndicate.
Yeah. We're printing that right now. It's at the printer.
Oh,
for
great.
The first act of it is coming out in paperback. It's actually, the paperback's going to be the same size as those Darwin Cook Parker books, like
oh, 6 cool.
by awesome. 9, a little bit smaller than comic size.
It's a great book. It's like a, I don't know, I'm going to say like an Encyclopedia Brown, Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew kind of story. Would you agree with that?
But with like more of a horror vibe. Yeah. Like,
yes,
like,
exactly.
Like if Lovecraft was doing like YA books in the 60s.
Yeah.
And it has that like I told Marcos when we started working on it, I was like, it takes place in this timeless 1970s New England that doesn't really exist anymore. But like, think about like Wes Anderson movies, how they always kind of feel like they're the late 60s or early 70s, but they just don't specify. Like, that's been a blast. Marcos is a much slower artist than Sean, but we published the chapters digitally.
And you can get them on a Panel Syndicate and you just get it right syndicate. To download it right to your,
you can pay whatever you want, get it for pay nothing and read it or pay money and read it. And, we're collecting
it's great.
It's a 3-act story and we're collecting those like 3 chapters at a time, and then we'll hopefully put out a big deluxe edition of the whole thing when it's done. But Marcos is just about wrapped up with the 4th chapter. We're hoping that'll come out the same day as the trade paperback collection of the first.
Awesome.
I love it. Ed, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on this Quar Chat. Destroy All Monsters, which is the 3rd in the Reckless book series, comes out on October 20th. You can get it at your local comic book store. You can get it at a little bookstore. You can find it anywhere online. But also just go to the brick and mortar stores. Support them as well. Panel Syndicate is where you can find Friday. And if you want to get Catwoman, I would say wait for that omnibus. Or
otherwise, you're paying a lot of money on eBay, which, spoiler alert, is what I did.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
But by the way, as we were talking here, I just purchased Blast of Silence because I've never even heard of that. And they have it on Amazon, too. So you can get that.
Yeah, and the Criterion cover art by Sean Phillips.
Yeah, which is amazing. Really, really great.
Excellent.
All right.
Well, thanks
so much,
Ed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Jason. And now, on to next week's film. Now that we got Malignant out of the way, let's talk about our next film. We are going from Killer Malignants to Killer Cats. That's right. Next week, we are watching the 1987, not so classic, Uninvited. Now, just want to warn you, it's the 1987 Uninvited, not the new Uninvited. Here's a short breakdown of the plot. Spring break teens and an escaped laboratory mutant cat board a yacht with a financier and his henchmen. Oh, boy. I cannot wait for you to watch this. Rotten Tomatoes gives us no score. And Stacey Wilson, who is the only fan critic to review this movie, says this movie is a real hairball of a horror film. Let's take a listen to the trailer.
They say cats have 9 lives. You have only 1.
A poisonous cat. Now, how's that possible?
You're gonna be richer than your wildest dreams.
Nothing's gonna keep me from getting to the Caymans.
Now start the engine and get us headed for the Caymans.
Thing's gonna bite us, and we're all gonna die a horrible death.
You can buy or rent Uninvited on Amazon Prime or Apple TV. You can even watch it on Amazon Prime with commercials if you don't want to pay for it. Or please always check your local public libraries where you can find many movies for free. So good. And you know what? We like to be fair and balanced here on the show. That's why on today's episode of Movie Bitches, we are going to have a 2-minute Malignant review. That's right. Our amazing producer, Avril Halley, is breaking down the movie with special guest James Mansfield. Take a listen. 2-minute Malignant review starts now.
Cheers. Welcome to Movie Bitches.
Hey, everybody.
A very special episode because we have James Mansfield with us.
What is this movie y'all made me watch?
Today we're reviewing Malignant.
The new James Wan film from 2021 that everybody's talking about. I love this movie, I think. It has a slow middle, but I had a great time. I was laughing till I gave myself a headache. So that's my hot take.
This movie wants to be like 8 different better and not so better movies.
Uh-huh. Dead Ringers, How to Get Ahead in Advertising, all the Frank Henlotter, Basket Case, Brain Damage.
I had wrote it down in my notes, like, I'm pretty sure James Wan fell asleep during The Eyes of Laura Mars and woke up in Basket Case.
Oh my God, yes!
I do appreciate the B-movie quality of it. Like, this was not a real movie.
No. Well, so it starts and the New Line Cinema logo popped up, which was so nostalgic. Oh, I was so excited. They got their start in Midnight Movies. I think they originally distributed Pink Flamingos. But the fact that this is on HBO Max and it's this big studio movie and it's this. Oh, I just loved it. I ate it up with a spoon.
I was high as a kite when I watched this. I was convinced the lead actress was Dakota Johnson.
Oh my God.
She was in the Dakota Johnson drag. Like everyone's in some sort of drag of somebody else more famous than them.
That wig really gave away a lot of plot points. It was like, oh, they needed to hide the blood pack back. That's why the wig's so awful. Oh, they're hiding some other things back there too. Okay, I see. I see what's happening. Well, James Wan made, you know, all of the money for Aquaman. And basically they said, do whatever you want. And I'm happy that he did this swing versus, you know, another Conjuring movie or something. So I would say thumbs up for me. It was something to behold.
Certainly that.
That's it for the show. Please remember to rate and review us. It helps. Tell your friends all about the show. We love having you here and listening. And remember to visit us on Twitter and Instagram and Discord. We love seeing your comments and we love seeing your malignants. And if you want to hear this show commercial free, you can do that. You can just sign up for Stitcher Premium. You can get a 1-month free trial by using the code BONKERS. And Stitcher Premium, the app is getting better, people. It's getting better. A big thank you to our producer, Cody, for putting this together. Our brilliant engineer, Devin. And of course, our MVP, Molly. A shout out to Avril Halley and the Movie Bitches. You can follow them always on YouTube. A big thank you to July Diaz for listening through, making sure this episode sounds perfect, and everyone at Earwolf for making this possible. We will see you next time for The Uninvited. Remember, the 1987 version of Uninvited with cats and a boat.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
I love Squarespace. I've built all my websites on Squarespace because it is the all-in-one platform that helps me build my brand for my podcast. It helps grow the brand. And what's so great about it is you don't have to be a designer. No, 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 no. You can get a beautiful website. You can engage with your audience and you can sell anything, your products, your content, and even your time. You have member areas where you can basically have like a gated community. You can let people in. You can have videos behind there. This whole summer, you can maybe decide to share a newsletter with your followers. And guess what? Squarespace makes it easy for you to do. I mean, I would like to maybe have a tour update. Maybe I would just send out an email like, hey, this is what happened last night. Here's some photos. That would actually be a great idea. Maybe we should do that through Squarespace. Anyway, you can also now create pro level videos because Squarespace has a video studio app. Yeah, they are stepping up their game, and they already were great. Go to squarespace.com/bonkers for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code BONKERS, that's B-O-N-K-E-R-S, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.